With our guest this hour, Cal Cooper, Telephone Calls from the Dead. We're going to take your phone calls now. Let me read you this email from Myron that came in. It says, the other night, Super Moon Night, George, I received a phone call from my father, who passed away in April of 2010. He said, Myron, tell Daryl to take it easy. He's been driving a lot lately. That was it. It hung up. I can't call in my wife's sleeping. Daryl is my little brother. The next day I told him that I got a phone call from Dad. He didn't believe me, so I mentioned what Dad said. My brother's face turned white. He then told me he got a ticket the night before. Phone calls from the dead. Back with Cal Cooper in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Cal Cooper with us. Cal, what did you think of that email, the fact that he got a call from his dad who died several years ago?
It's certainly incredible. They really do match the other kind of experiences that people have been having as well. And, you know, look at how common these are as well. People everywhere seem to be having them, yet there's not all that much written on them. It's only in recent times that we've started to highlight them again. And certainly, George, you're no stranger to them as well, because you've written about them as well.
Yeah. They're everywhere. They're just great stories. They really are. When is science, Cal, going to jump on this bandwagon and try to find out what's going on scientifically?
Well, I think it tried a while ago. It's still trying now. It's just having to use trial and error for different occurrences. I mean, if we just slightly push the phone calls to one side for a second and just look at EVP in general, it was in the 1950s that Raymond Bayliss, who was the co-author of Phone Calls from the Dead, he was doing research with the medium Attila von Zelay, and they'd rented an apartment and they used it specifically as a recording studio, and they built soundproof boxes and they were using reel-to-reel recorders and other tape recorders, and they put the tape recorder inside the soundproof box, and by the fact that they had a psychic there, Attila von Zelay, they'd sit in silence and just wait while the tape was recording for anything to appear. And upon playback, they found scratches, taps, maybe whispers and voices, even though it was in a soundproof box, and they believed that it was because they had the medium present, it was promoting these anomalous sounds on tape. And Raymond Bayliss published his report on this before it was known as EVP. He just published his report of strange psychokinetic tape recording, or numerous different terms he called it, but he published it in the Journal of the American Society for Psychical Research. And then 3 months later, Frederick Jurgensen, who was recording bird sounds at the time, reported that he'd heard anomalous sounds within the recordings. And he kind of got the fame and the popularity for recording it and reporting it. So there's loads of people in the scientific field that have been producing academic reports on such things. And it even goes back, like my book highlights it so much, going back to the wireless telegraph, people reporting anomalous communication over that when they'd taken out the receiving wire, and the early telephones as well. And in modern research, science has tried to look at it in numerous ways. One of the best ways is if we can actually record one of these supposed telephone calls from the dead. We can compare the voice of the dead to that same person if we have a recording of them when they were alive. There's one person called Paolo Prezzi who published in the ITC journal, and he published a report comparing these voices. And the best one that he got was the psychologist, Dr. Konstantin Radova, who's very famous for publishing the book Breakthrough and doing numerous experiments with EVP, and it had an accompanying LP record that you could listen to the EVP recordings. And after he died, numerous people reported having telephone calls from the dead from Dr. Radova. There was reports in Germany, France, and also in the USA. And a couple of these people had actually recorded these conversations over the telephone, so they could compare his voice before and after death. Now, to listen to the recordings, they sounded perfect. It sounded like Dr. Radova actually on the phone, and no one doubted that. But when they compared the audio acoustical properties, that's getting the computer to kind of match up the voice patterns, they didn't match. But that leaves us in a catch-22 situation for science, really, because you can say, okay, the rational explanation is they didn't match because it's someone creating a prank. It's fraud. That's why the voices don't match. Someone is just very good at impersonating Dr. Radova and then messing with the phone line so they can make sure that their phone number is untraceable, perhaps. other problem is that if we look at it in more of a paranormal aspect and go into a bit of philosophy of the paranormal, we could say, well, of course the voices aren't going to match, because when Dr. Adler's voice was originally recorded when he was alive, his speech was being produced through a physical voice box and through his physical biological body. After death, there's no physical body left. There's just whatever's left in, you know, in on planet Earth, in the EMF field, in the ether. And the dead would then have to manipulate electrons in the telephone line to produce a voice that sounds like what we could identify as the person that we knew when they were alive and living. That's why it wouldn't match.
Let's go to some of the calls here for you. Ready, Cal?
Yep.
Here's Alan in Ogden, Utah. Get us started here, Alan. Thank you.
Hey, thank you, George.
Mm-hmm.
I had an experience with a phone call, perhaps not from the dead, but from something on the other side, with a sister-in-law of mine who left a message on our answering machine several years ago with the usual stuff, you know, bye, see you later, she would always say at the end. And I was listening to that and heard her put down the phone, and she clicked off. And then there was a very threatening kind of male-sounding voice that came on mocking her and said, bye, see you later. And that particular event took place just shortly before she made a nearly successful suicide attempt. And I've always thought there was possibly some evil entity of some
sort that was edged her on.
Yeah.
Yeah, you never know. Yeah, have you heard of stories like that, Cal, where these entities try to harm you by having you attempt something horrible?
I've never heard of ones where they've kind of try to make people do things, except for some where you get a voice where they give you a sort of premonition, really. They'd say, you're going on a car journey tomorrow, don't. Because there's and the actual route you were going to take, there turns out to be a major car crash and pile up on that particular route you were going to take, so potentially you could have been involved in that. So it's helping you avoid danger. There's been a few cases as well of people that have been UFO, not necessarily abductees in some cases they were, but just people that had witnessed UFOs. After they had the experience, they received telephone calls from voices that either replicated their own voice and just mimicked them on the telephone, or they had strange voices like the one you just described being very deep and almost quite scaring people, which basically said, don't report your UFO experience, or basically saying, don't discuss your experience you had last night with anyone, don't talk to anyone, as though someone has been watching them and has access to their telephone number. But again, when you try to trace this call, these calls, about 50% of them, you never actually find out where it's come from, and it doesn't always show up on your bill. So I've never heard of one specifically where the voice has tried to control you or make you specifically do things in a negative way. So that's very interesting.
Let's go to Brenda in San Francisco, west of the Rockies. Good morning, Brenda.
Yes, good morning, George. It's a very exciting show tonight. I'm so excited. And Cal, thank you for your knowledge.
Oh, thanks. It's my pleasure.
Yes, I had one thing I wanted to share this evening, and this was in 1969. I lost my grandmother, and it was very traumatic. I was 6 years old at the time.
Oh, gee, yeah.
And excuse me, I'm a little nervous here. I was told that I passed out, and it took a little while to get over that. But a few months later, my mother was in the hospital giving birth, and an aunt and uncle came to stay. And there was a woman that would take me to the toilet in the evening. And when my mother arrived home, my uncle asked, who was that woman that would take Brenda to the toilet? So, you know, they couldn't come up with a name, so she thought, well, we'll pull the photo album out. And he pointed to my grandmother, and my mother said, you know, that can't be, she just passed away. And my uncle and my aunt turned white and fled from the house and never returned, at least, you know, while we were there.
Oh, my.
And
and you were too small to be scared, right?
I don't remember.
Yeah.
But, Cal, you know, I've thought throughout the years, Was it possibly that my grandmother was with me because she knew that I was having a hard time?
I'd certainly say there are a lot of cases that kind of match yours, and I'd certainly also say that it kind of goes back to that whole thing that children are more susceptible to having these paranormal experiences. They're very innocent towards them, and they're just acting on what comes natural. I mean, for you at the time, there's a lot of things that are going on that adults would have been dealing with, so you were just accepting what kind of came along. So it's possible that you were actually kind of encountering these apparitions as well. I mean, there's some people about your age, you say you were six,
yeah.
That there were some people that I've come across where they were about the same age, and they'd be sat at the kitchen table, and they didn't know that their grandma had passed away, and they'd get a telephone call, and it'd be their grandma, and she'd say, oh, look after yourself, I'm watching over you, something like that. Several of these accounts came up, and then they put the phone down, and bear in mind, they're only six, and then the parents would come in and say, the telephone just rang, who was that? Oh, it was grandma on the phone. Oh. And then later on, the parent had to explain to them, you know, grandma had died by the time you said you got that call, so who was it? And the child's just insistent saying, it was grandma's voice, grandma told me to do this. You know, they thought nothing of it because they didn't know of grandma's death, and they just accepted what came to them.
Mm-hmm. Carl, I wanted to make a comment. A caller called in earlier, and there was discussion about people being harmed.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a few years after my grandmother passed, my mother was at the kitchen table, and it all started with automatic writing. And from what I remember, I think at that time I was about 9 or 10, but what happened was a young man had taken over my mother's body. She was able to function during the day and go to work. You know, little things would happen, like she would go to lunch and she would order food that wasn't of her liking. And a couple of times she was with her peers and her voice changed and she asked for tuna sandwiches, which, you know, she didn't like. But as it turned out, this young man fell down a mine shaft in the hills, and the sheriff was involved with this, I failed to mention. But for weeks, my mother would drive out into the foothills, get us into the car, and this is how it all started. When the sheriff got involved, she was leading them to his body or where he fell. And right where he fell, just a few feet, they stopped. They all stopped, and this was all in the middle of the night. They all stopped, looked with the flashlight. There was a hole. They went back the next day, and they discovered his bones, his remains, and his dog.
Oh, jeez.
And they had, you know, they were able to contact the family, but the reason why he chose my mother, apparently, was because she was open that evening, and he wanted to find someone to let his family know that he was okay.
He moved on.
So anyway, I just wanted to share that, and thank you so much, George.
Thank you, Brenda.
Incredible. Thank you.
Good stories. Good questions, too. There's something on the other side, Cal. No doubt.
Yeah, absolutely.
I have no doubts at all.
That was certainly an incredible account as well. I mean, I'll go over to my book here, and I'll just kind of show you an example of some of the kind of earlier experiences
sure.
people had compared to the modern ones. I mean, the case that we just had there, the only one I can relate it to is one where someone was reporting text messages from the supposed dead or a spirit girl. And that's mentioned in my book as well, but this family had never had paranormal experiences before, and after they had the text messages or the phone-related experiences, that later turned into poltergeist activity. So we just had a case there where there was an early childhood episode, and then later on the family also had another strange paranormal event. So they seem to either happen just the once, or they can happen several times, or they can happen throughout your life. It's very strange when they do and don't occur. The case I've got here is one of the Type 2 calls, but it was in one of Rogo's files, and I thought it was fantastic. So I'll just read the account that was given. I cannot remember the exact year because it has been so long, but at any rate, my grandmother had one of those old war phones, the one with a crank, and you had to call so many shorts and longs for various individuals. My grandmother and I would often walk a mile and a quarter to town and back, always leaving her doors open. Whether or not someone took advantage of this situation, is not known. However, her phone bill was higher than usual, and we walked to a neighbour, and she offered him the nickel for the call to Central. They called the operator Central in those days. He refused the money and said, use it. She called concerning a call we received early the night before. She asked why the phone was not disconnected, as she had asked earlier in the week. The operator went through her papers and said, Mrs. Sayer, that was disconnected, for I have the order before me and signed by the lineman. My grandmother said, it couldn't be, because I received a call from Lizzie Partlett in Parksboro, West Virginia, saying that she was going away, but that everything was all right, and that she could only say a few words and said that you will hear in a few days. Her voice seemed so hollow and had a faraway manner about it, and yet she could hear every word. The lineman came out in the evening and climbed the pole. He pointed out to my grandmother the new white wire that was wound around the pole and not connected. Then he went up to the house and pointed out the wire there, also disconnected. He explained that the other wire connected to a lightning arrestor for safety's sake. Mrs. Sayer, the line could not operate broken in two places, and only one break in the line is sufficient. My grandmother insisted that it did, and he looked as one doubting her sanity, mumbled a few words and said it wouldn't happen again in his opinion. In about 3 days, she received a letter from the Partlett family saying that Mrs. Partlett died in the early night of the day before the letter was written. Mail travelled slow, even by train in those days, and living on a rural route caused it to be even later. The impossible call was made at the time she passed away and has remained a mystery ever since.
I love those stories. Let's squeeze one more in before the break. Greg, truck driving in Missouri. Go ahead, Greg.
Hey, George, how you doing?
Good, Greg.
My father passed away in August of 09, and all of a sudden I started getting these weird, it would break into my phone conversations on my cell phone, and it would last an indeterminate amount of time, sometimes real long, sometimes short, but it was like a garbled message, and I know it was my dad. I even changed phones. I changed headphones because I wear a set of headphones for the truck and the Bluetooth headphones. And it persisted. And it started out kind of on a pattern at only one place. I would be at one place on the highway, and it would happen. And then it started happening everywhere. And then it died off, and it didn't happen anymore. And then when my aunt... my dad's sister passed away in December of that same year. It started again immediately and really fired up real good, you know. And most of the time, it would cut off the other caller and just let me hear it. And then it started where both callers could hear it. And other people were like, what was that, you know? And then my... dad's other sister's husband just died recently. I went to his funeral, and after we got back from his funeral, I got about an hour long. I was talking to my wife on my cell phone and on her cell phone, and I got about an hour long call of this same thing, and we both listened to it, the whole thing. And it's just garbled, and you can almost hear words.
But you know there's something there. We're at the break, and we'll be right back. On our next Coast to Coast program, Richard Dolan and Bryce Zabel join us as we talk about disclosure. Will it happen? Well, stand by for that. But when we come back in a moment with Cal Cooper, we shall take your final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. What kind of equipment have you taken, Cal, on any of these investigations?
It varies, really. When I first started out, you just got your kind of typical EMF meter, and the main thing I can suggest any investigator taking is yourself, a flashlight if you do have the lights out or if there's darkened places, a pencil, a pad of paper, and a watch. Just what you see and document are the best piece of investigation equipment that you can actually use. I've got various colleagues in parapsychology that have been known for using various kinds of ghost hunting equipment. There's people like Steve Parsons. He looks at infrasound and EMF and done loads of investigations looking specifically at these things. So you've got electromagnetic fields and looking for unusual areas of EMF in certain locations where we have high electromagnetic fluctuation activity, and how it coincides with people, their psychological reaction to the building. So if people report apparitions in a certain room, is that because we have high EMF in there? Is it because we have the presence of infrasound, which is low-frequency sound, which fluctuates below 20 hertz, and it causes people to have these experiences, or more so, it promotes their experiences? A lot of people will be familiar with London Underground.
Sure.
And with all the trains rushing through the tunnels and being so far under the ground, it just creates a perfect kind of base for infrasound, and it just pushes this low-frequency sound all through the tunnel. So when you're down on the platforms, you can feel sick. You'll get the hairs on the back of your neck standing up, a sense of presence, everything that you experience or report in a typical haunting. So when I've been on investigations, you know, I've set up video cameras, used kind of security equipment like the beam barriers, so you can detect if anything breaks the beam when it walks through. EMF meters, check for temperature. But the main thing I do when I go on investigations as a psychologist and a parapsychologist is I document everything people are doing, everything they're saying, and compare it to previous eyewitness testimony as well. I think we're going to learn the most from that, from my side as a psychologist. I have to leave the physicists to do what they got to do.
All right, back to the phones we go. Let's go to Matt in Las Vegas, west of the Rockies. Hey, Matt, thanks for calling.
Hey, how you doing, George?
Good, Matt. All is well. Thank you.
I had an experience about 2 years ago, and my grandpa had died. He was around 83 years old. And when I was a child, my grandpa always used to tell me every time he would experience something paranormal or something out of the ordinary, I was always in the presence of him. Not really sure what significance that had. But a couple days after he had passed away, I had gotten a phone call in my house, and it was just on one phone in my bedroom. None of the other phones in the house rang, and I picked up the phone, and it sounded what was like a robotic voice, kind of sounding a little demonic. Now, it started to say my name, and it faded out. And about 2 months ago at work, I had received another phone call, and it was the same voice, because usually at my work, when I get a phone call in my department, there is a announcer on the mic saying there is a phone call for this department.
Right,
but
right.
Just a phone call in my back room rang, and it was the same exact robotic voice that had said my name, and I heard what kind of sounded like my grandfather's voice. It made the hairs on the back of my neck stand up. It was very odd.
What do you think, Cal? Possible?
There's loads of accounts that kind of report this kind of thing, especially when you've recently lost someone or someone close to you that you've lost, and you still have fond memories of them. And in some cases, people are longing to at least have some form of connection again. One of the things they report in the phone call experiences when they hear the telephone ring and they pick it up, it's just the deceased saying the person who's receiving the call's name over and over again. And there's a few accounts that I've kind of highlighted as well in my research where people had these. They were just about to go to bed, and the telephone rang, the one closest to them, and the deceased on the other end of the line that they distinctly recognized. The voice was, you know, so prominent, they just heard the voice saying their name over and over again. It gradually faded out and into static. And you've raised an interesting point there, the fact that it was the telephone that was closest to you. There's quite a few cases where, especially again around about the type 1 cases, that people report it was the telephone closest to them that rang. And if you've got a landline telephone, you'd expect maybe there's one in the living room, maybe one in the bedroom, one in the hallway. So why didn't the other telephones ring? And for parapsychology, it said, well, if these are paranormal and we have this longing to speak to the dead, it could A, be psychokinetic, and we've made the telephone ring. So we have spoon bending. That's psychokinetic. That's trying to affect the metal with the power of the mind. So in this case, we're affecting the telephone with the power of the mind. We're making the bell ring to actually produce the telephone call. But as Rogan Bayliss thought, as Thomas Edison thought, and a few other people that were involved in kind of theories and ideas of the mechanics of telephone calls from the dead, they believed that it was the electron. sounds within the telephone line that the dead are supposedly manipulating to create the ringing and create the voice that we recognize on the other end of the line. And this is why it's just the telephone that's closest to us that rings. And people also reported that it was definitely paranormal because the bell tone wasn't the same. It was either just one ring or it was a lower ring than what you normally hear from that telephone, as though that the hammers inside the telephone couldn't actually get up to the normal speed to hit the bells.
They know. They know how to use technology, don't they?
Well, Raymond Bayless said, as we keep on investigating these things, they're just going to get more complex if we advance with the times and we keep on bringing in new technology. And you'll see in my book that I've gone all the way from the early 1900s with a wireless telegraph all the way through to modern mobile phones, text messages, and emails as well. And there's a variety of psychological explanations to consider. There's also a variety of paranormal explanations to consider. And then once we've looked at those and we don't think they possibly apply, I've even gone into even more radical theories, really kind of strange theories of consciousness that people like Dr. Lyle Watson have mentioned in his book, The Nature of Things. He's discussed the idea that do inanimate objects have a mind of their own? Is it possible for machines and robots to have consciousness? So therefore, is it possible that the telephone is actually doing this itself? In his book, he discussed quite a few cases of people reporting their microwave coming to life, someone's oven was speaking to them in Dutch, someone's hairdryer, electrical appliances, they've been talking dirty to them, someone's chainsaw started singing to him randomly and he dropped it and it cut off his toe. And the explanation for all these experiences in those cases was that they were near certain power plants that had high electrical outputs that were creating a kind of, all these electrical appliances were creating receivers for radio signals. So you were getting snippets of voices coming over different items within the home, which, you know, that's very, it's not the first kind of explanation you jump to for such a thing. But when you hear such cases being true stories, all of a sudden a telephone call from the dead doesn't sound so unusual. But that doesn't mean to say that all telephone calls from the dead are explainable.
Well, that's true. The one of the individuals you're talking about with that book, Dr. Scott Rogo?
Yep.
He died at the age of, what, 40?
Yeah,
he was murdered.
Yep, absolutely. He wrote up to 30 books and over 100 academic publications. And he was unfortunately murdered in his home at the age of 40 in 1990, sorry. And people still highly reference his work today, even in parapsychology, because he was fantastic. I mean, Lloyd Auerbach, who's one of my friends and colleagues over in the U.S., who's also been on the show before.
Yeah.
I've had a few conversations with him because it was thanks to him that I got in contact with various other people in the States that had worked with Scott Rogo or Raymond Bayless. And Lloyd was taught by Scott Rogo when he was at John F. Kennedy University as well. And Scott was teaching an experimental course in parapsychology there. It was just incredible back in February because Lloyd got me in contact with Dr. Elizabeth McAdams, who'd written a book with Raymond Bayless, which mentioned in a chapter phone calls from the dead. And then they invited me over to go and talk on phone calls from the dead in Southern California. And I also, while I was there, I had the opportunity to travel up to North Hollywood, and I went to meet Jack Rogo. So I went to see Scott Rogo's father, and that was just incredible. I saw all Scott's books there.
Oh, that's great.
I got
great.
To see the home that he grew up in, and it was just such a pleasure to just spend time with Jack. He's a Pearl Harbor veteran as well, so hearing his stories about that, wow, it was an incredible trip, and I'm never going to forget it. And it also kind of pulled together the book for me, because that was the time I was just finishing the book, and I'd met people that knew Raymond Bayless. I saw his paintings, because he was a landscape artist in California. And I went to where Scott grew up. I got to meet his family. I got to spend time with them. And I never got to meet either author, sadly. So, you know, this for me was the closest I could get to them.
Sure.
I felt so connected. I thought it was brilliant. It was a fantastic trip.
How were they handling his death, Cal?
How were they handling his death?
Yeah, emotionally. Had they gotten over it by then?
Oh yeah. I mean, at the time they were investigating it, I think Scott's mother thought it was some prowler that just walked off the street. And
he caught him. He caught him in his apartment or something.
Yeah, that's what they thought. And then they had numerous kind of psychics actually working on the case, funnily enough. And Colin Wilson discussed this. Colin Wilson was friends with Scott Rogo. He wrote an article about the psychics involved. The police were using any kind of any kind of links they could just to at least find out who the killer was. In Scott's study, Scott was obsessive for being tidy and tidying up. He'd never leave plates out or anything. They found a wine glass in his study that had a smeared thumbprint on. And at the time of 1990, the forensics weren't that great to actually get a really good, accurate copy of the thumbprint off the glass.
Right.
And it wasn't until 2 years later the police had someone in mind who it could be. And then psychics gave this right impression of this guy with a mustache, dark hair, leather jacket. And then one psychic came forward who knew nothing about the circumstances of how Scott was found and what was in the office. But they said, there is a wine glass in the office. Someone has touched it. The killer has touched it. Go back to the wine glass. Get it checked again. And this was in 1992. So even in that space of 2 years, forensics had advanced. And they had the wine glass checked again. They managed to get an accurate thumbprint, and it matched up to the person they suspected. And he got arrested for the murder of Scott.
The killer actually was drinking from his wine?
I think they were good friends at one time. It was known to Scott. They were good friends, so he'd been over to the
something happened
apartment numerous
yeah.
times, and they must have had an argument, and one thing led to another.
Okay, let's go back to the phone. Sioux Falls, South Dakota, east of the Rockies. Troy, go ahead.
Yes, Mr. Norrie, Mr. Cooper, thank you for taking my call.
You are welcome.
Well, thank you.
Well, I was a service member, and I was stationed at RAF Upper Hayford in the early 80s, and that's the first time I've ever had experience with the paranormal. Two of my roommates and I moved to a small village called Blakesley outside of Upper Hayford, and we lived in this 300-year-old house, and they would sit there and talk about me playing ball in the house. Well, I wasn't playing ball at all. They'd wake up in the middle of the night, and they would see a young boy sitting in the corner of their room bouncing a ball. And then when they'd sit up to talk to it, it would throw the ball at them and then disappear. And then I used to tease them about that many, many times. And then finally we had to move from that house. They didn't like it when that ghost would appear, or spirit, whatever you want to call it, would appear. And I'd tease them about it. Well, when we got to the new house in the same village, they were TDY out of country, and I was talking to my then fiance on the phone. She was in Cape Cod, and I was talking to her. The Super Bowl had just started. This was in 84, and all of a sudden I heard some dishes rustling in the kitchen, and I go to the kitchen and thought maybe something collapsed or whatever. The dishes are on end standing on the counter. That just freaked me out so bad. I was on the phone with my fiance for the whole Super Bowl. And then a month later, I was frightened again when I got my phone bill, and it was a little over 900 pounds. My fiance was coming over to England. She was getting stationed at Alconbury, and she ended up getting a flat in Nottingham. And it was over in an old mill. And we used to hear water running under it, which there is no water under it at that time. Water in the house would turn on and off. We'd hear giggling, and something would push me when we were in bed and then tickle her feet and giggle. And
mischievous thing, huh?
It was a wonderful experience. I've never had it. I never believed in it before, but that's the one thing I loved about England. I do love your country. I just love the history, and the paranormal activity has just got to be so high there, and it was just a wonderful experience, I thought.
That's a great story. Thank you, Troy. Yeah. Appreciate that. What is it about the United Kingdom, about England, that has that very special feeling of ghosts and entities, Cal?
I don't know. I mean, I've discussed this with Ron Kolick before on our show. We've tried to compare the USA with the UK for hauntings. And is the UK more recognized because we're kind of a smaller country with really old stone buildings that go back for hundreds of years, various pubs and castles and so forth? Is it just purely because it's smaller that people kind of take more note of the hauntings in every town that you actually go into that's only, you know, a few miles away? Whereas in the US, you have to travel some considerable distance in some case to actually then get to a new haunted location. And also, the structure of the buildings is different. You have a lot of buildings that are made of wood as well. And is there a difference in the building structure that makes the haunting different? Are buildings that are made of wood more prominent to haunting activity than buildings that are made of stone? And certainly, there's kind of different variations with what people report in the US and UK, but generally the phenomena itself remains relatively the same. same. But I think everyone likes this kind of whole idea of the history of the UK, because we've got old buildings in London, we've got Jack the Ripper, we've got Robin Hood, and these legends and tales that go back.
The great movie Christmas Carol, all that stuff.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, the Christmas Carol was a great thing for sparking interest in ghosts for people.
Sure is, absolutely.
Sitting around and discussing them. There's a brilliant little book produced by Harry Price, who I mentioned earlier, being one of the UK's most famous early ghost hunters, and he produced a tiny little book called Christmas Ghosts. It's very, very rare to get hold of, but he discussed Charles Dickens' view on ghosts, and he said it was most likely that Charles Dickens himself didn't believe in ghosts. Certainly from the way he wrote, it doesn't appear that he did believe in ghosts, but he knew that they were an excellent source of entertainment, and he included in the Christmas Carol the current thinking on how and why people experience ghosts. And some people at that time in the Victorian period, they thought that you could experience ghosts because of indigestion troubles. And this is why when Scrooge encounters Jacob Marley, he says, why do you doubt your senses, Scrooge? Why do you doubt what you're seeing? And he says, well, because the little things can affect them. You're probably nothing but an undigested bit of...
That's
meat,
right. I remember that.
Rubber mustard. There's more of gravy than of grave about you.
I love it. Cal, we are out of time. Thank you so much for everything. Keep in touch with us, all right?
Oh, thank you very much for having me on, George. It's been absolutely great. And the listeners, the calls that have come in, and also listening to Neil earlier, it's been fantastic.
You are a great guest. Cal Cooper's website, calcooper.com, linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. Fascinating night. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasour, Stephanie Smith, George Knapp, John B. Wells, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.